Chapter 4, October. The weather in San Angelo had turned cold and rainy hours before the front reached Garner State Park. It stayed like that for over a week. Afternoons were spent making the rounds to each home, except for Justin's, because there just wasn't much to do there. Emmett had an Odyssey game system, and Trent owned just about every Hot Wheel ever manufactured. Time spent at Christopher's house was usually Star Wars action figures or Legos, although Kyle and Justin seldom participated. Kyle usually wanted to watch sports when they were at his house, which only interested him and Justin, so the group did split up from time to time. The weather oscillated throughout October. There were some nice days during the week, but the weekends were consistently cold and wet until late October. It all lifted by the last Thursday before Halloween, and so the boys started getting serious about returning to Little Africa. After much discussion about weaponry, tactics, and stealth, it was initially decided that Saturday would be the right time to retake their territory, if necessary. Nobody really knew whether the surprise attack was a one-time event or if the assailants would be back and ready to fight, possibly with reinforcements. While there was great anxiety about what might await them at Little Africa, it was also exciting to contemplate all of the possible scenarios and prepare for war. The group attempted to coordinate a sleepover on Friday night, but they were unable to work it into the various schedules. The goal was to spend the evening rehearsing the plan and discussing contingencies. However, Trent had a birthday to attend at Shakey's Pizza, while Emmett was scheduled to be at the Nazarene Church Hallelujah Night. He was conflicted about spending the evening at church because it was also Christian Skate Night at Eight Wheels Skating Rink. There was a girl from McGill Elementary named Heather that Emmett really liked, and she was almost always at Christian Skate Night. As for Justin, he was booked for a school-sponsored student mingle night at Sherwood Lane's bowling alley. Kyle and James were going with Robert to see Odessa Permian play Central. After much discussion, it was decided that they should postpone one more week, so that they'd have time to really prepare for any situation, or so they thought. Chris was the one dissenting vote, since he was anxious to storm the castle and retake his territory. But he finally capitulated and agreed that they shouldn't approach the enemy half-cocked. Each member of the group went to their respective events on Friday night, which left only Christopher with no plans. He was facing a long night alone because Laura was geared up for a busy shift working the floor at Fiddlestrings. She left the house at 6:44 p.m. without saying goodbye. Staying home by himself until the late evening and sometimes until the early morning of the following day was common for Chris. It happened on both weeknights and weekends, but Laura's absence on Fridays was always much longer. Sometimes she did not return home until sunrise on Saturday morning. It made Chris uneasy to be left alone, especially after their experiences at Little Africa and Garner State Park. He made no mention of the mysterious, creeping dark mass to Laura. She wouldn't believe him and wouldn't care to investigate the claims, and he knew that. He had devised a few coping mechanisms to get through the long nights when Laura was away. One part of the plan was to leave the front door open so that only the screen separated the interior from the outside. The screen door was white and made partially of wood slats, not unlike those on the semi-primitive shelters at Garner State Park, but much narrower. The upper half was wire screen mesh. Chris was of the misguided impression that he would be safe behind the screen as long as it was locked from the inside, not considering that any intruder with malintent would just punch through it and unlock the small metal clasp. But Chris hardly gave a second thought to the possibility of a malevolent human attempting to break in. His fears were more otherworldly. even before they had encountered the creeping darkness. It gave him some comfort to hear the activity outside. There was a rhythmic whoosh of the cars in motion because their house was near the intersection of Howard and North Street. The sound and movement somehow caused Chris to feel connected to the community. Having only the thin screen between himself and live human beings gave him some sense of security. In his mind, if something unusual occurred, he could easily run out and flag down a passerby. Of course, this was only an option when the weather wasn't too cold. On really cold nights, he had to close the front door, which caused him to feel isolated and trapped inside the small two-bedroom house. The blinds on the large window in the living room were always kept open, whether the door was closed or not, and that helped a little when it got too cold outside. Another part of his strategy was to set up base camp on the living room couch that was on the far left wall if one were standing at the large living room window and looking out. The wall ran the full depth of the living room from the front of the house to a door that led to the utility room. Another door across the utility room led out to the small garage. This meant that Chris could lock the door to the garage and close the utility room door, providing a continuous plane with no dark voids. From that vantage point, he was protected from behind and could see the entire living room. The entrance to both the dining room and the hallway were also both visible. A short hallway diagonally opposite from his fortress ran parallel to the couch and led to three rooms. Laura's bedroom on the right, the bathroom in the middle, and Chris's room to the left at the end of the hall. Using the restroom meant that he would enter through the hallway door and turn left, then immediately right. Chris's bedroom was at the front of the house, while Laura's was at the back. Therefore, if both bedroom doors were open, he could stand in his room and see all the way to the back wall of the house while looking through the short hallway and into Laura's bedroom. Chris would set up on the couch with some toys and snacks on the coffee table, buried under a thick quilt, and staring at the console television that was on the back wall of the living room. From there, he had a sense that nothing could surprise him. If anything were to emerge from the hallway or the dining room, then he would have time to bolt for the front door. It seemed like the safest place with the best vantage point and close enough to the window to see headlights as cars went to and fro on North Street, at least until the late evening when most of the town was asleep. Chris would watch TV until he could not keep his eyes open, usually around 11 p.m. Then he would retreat into the quilt, covered head to toe with the TV left on. By morning, Laura would be in her bedroom and he would have survived another night. It never bothered Laura that he was sleeping with the front door wide open. She knew that it exposed him to any opportunistic criminal who took notice in the middle of the night, yet she never took issue with the arrangement. She postulated that anybody who wanted in would get in one way or another, so there was no good reason to challenge Christopher's habit if it made him feel more secure. It was more of a rationalization so that she didn't have to change anything regarding her routine. The three off-air network channels that Chris could watch were very much part of the ritual. He knew the schedule of every show on each of them. On Fridays, he would first watch Dukes of Hazzard, then Knight Rider, and finally Fantasy Island, although that one scared him sometimes. That would get him to the KLST 10 o'clock news. There was a new weatherman who was obviously learning on the job with his first assignment at an actual news station. Chris both laughed and cringed from the first night that he arrived until he began to hone his craft and became more comfortable in his role as the evening news weatherman. He had first shown up back in August and could hardly get through a forecast without many pregnant pauses, staring wide-eyed at the camera and completely overcome with stage fright. He would stammer all over himself, and sometimes they would have to cut back to the news desk while he recovered. By October, he was fairly comfortable, and Chris was relieved because it reduced the level of embarrassment that he felt for the man. There were still moments of frazzled discombobulation on occasion, but the mistakes were decreasing and his recovery time was improving. Chris eventually started to feel almost like they knew each other, and it gave him comfort to have time with the not-so-new weatherman each night. It was Johnny Carson and Late Night with David Letterman after the KLST local news concluded. His goal was to be asleep by the time they played the national anthem and the local network went off air. If he made it that far and was not asleep, then the last resort was to read. Sometimes he would also play Neil Diamond records just so that the creaks and groans of the small old house would be masked. On this night, the weather wasn't too cold, and so he was able to leave the front door open. He sat in his safe place and ate ravioli as the news ran. It was cold because he had heated it much earlier while the sun was still up so that he wouldn't have to walk back to the kitchen by himself after dark. He was especially riveted this night because the reporter was on location at an enormous hole in the ground, standing at the intersection of Howard and what would eventually become the Houston-Hart Freeway. The city had exercised eminent domain on a swath of homes just about 1 mile south of North Street, and then bulldozed two full city blocks for almost 4 miles all the way from Bryant Boulevard to Glenna. The intention was to build a new freeway that would connect up with the existing one on the southwest side of town. The 10-year plan was to create a loop that would greatly reduce traffic on Sherwood Way and improve mobility in San Angelo overall. The problem was that the houses had been bulldozed 2 years prior and some excavation had been done, but all progress had come to a halt. There had been no heavy machinery at work for about 4 months, and nobody really knew why. What led to the news report was an enormous hole about 1/2 acre square right next to Howard. They had dug the pit for some unknown reason and then just left it there. Chris knew it well because he and the others had discovered that the slanted sides were at a pitch that would really accelerate a bicycle. They did a lot of riding in that hole, using the decline to gain momentum enough to ride across the flat bottom and almost make it up the other side. Justin once said that he liked it even more than Little Africa, and that made Chris really angry. Chris and Emmett had never quite made it completely up the opposing side, but Kyle, Justin, and Trent had successfully powered all the way to the top multiple times. For Chris and Emmett, it was always the walk of shame, but they kept trying. It was also fun to ride partially up the side in a half circle, speeding back down and weaving back onto the slant, going around the square and using gravity to increase velocity, similar to Little Africa, but much more uniform. The concern that the reporter was investigating was the lack of appreciable progress for several months. The whole project was already supposed to be much further along. Residents who fought the land grab were furious to be forcibly relocated, only to see it stall out, especially so early on. Those who lived alongside the forthcoming new freeway were concerned because the hole had filled with several feet of water from the recent rains. They were worried that it would stagnate and breed mosquitoes, or worse, that a child would fall into the unprotected hole and drown. Chris thought that was a dumb concern because it was only about knee-deep, if that. He wondered if they'd seen him and the others riding on it when it was dry. The problem was that information regarding the work stoppage was not forthcoming. Concho Valley Excavation Corporation was not returning calls, and all attempts to find a manager at the company headquarters near Twin Buttes Reservoir were unsuccessful. Nobody seemed to know what had been paid, what the overall status was, or who was even responsible for the project in general. It was during this story on KLST that Chris heard Laura call out to him. The voice came from her bedroom, catty-corner from where he sat on the couch. If he had looked, then he could see into the darkness of the bedroom from where he sat. But he didn't look. Instead, because he was so enthralled in the KLST news story, he reflexively yelled out, "Yeah, Mom?" Then he kept watching the story. It concluded within only about a minute, leaving more questions than answers. Janine Maxwell, the investigative reporter on location, assured the viewers that she was going to follow up and would provide more information as it became available. Then they cut to a commercial advertising steak fingers at the charcoal house. Chris was salivating over the steaming steak fingers that looked excessively better than his cold ravioli when it dawned on him that Laura calling out didn't make sense. She wasn't supposed to be there. At least, he didn't think she was home. He glanced over at her bedroom door inquisitively, perplexed that it was open. Chris always closed all of the doors except for the bathroom when he was home alone. But if Laura was home, then it would make sense. He sat and stared at the pitch-dark doorway for several seconds before lifting the quilt and standing up next to the couch. He was pensive but not yet afraid, questioning himself while walking across the living room. Was it his imagination? Did he actually hear somebody outside who sounded like Laura? He was so fixated on the news broadcast that he was only barely conscious of that moment. But one thing was certain. The door was open, although he had closed it. Either Laura really was home, or something was very wrong. He walked to the hallway entrance and called out, "Mom, are you there?" No response. His adrenaline levels elevated as fear crept over him like a black veil. With all of the courage he could gather, Chris stepped to the bedroom door and reached in for the light. But he could not find the switch. He frantically felt all along the wall beyond the door jamb until finally encountering the light switch and turning on the light. Nobody was in the room. The bed was unmade, but that was common. Chris leaned in to see the closet door that was on the wall to his left, wondering if perhaps Laura was in the closet. The door was closed. It was a small closet that had no light, and so he knew she wasn't in there. Chris stepped back out of the room and assessed his own recollection, searching the recesses of his subconscious to determine if he'd truly heard what he thought he heard. Then it occurred to him that if Laura was home, then her car would be in the driveway. He turned to look diagonally across the living room and out the large window to the driveway. There was no car. Chris stood in that position for about 10 seconds, contemplating the whole matter, when the door suddenly slammed behind him. He whirled back around to see it closed only inches from his nose. Then he backed out of the hallway into the living room, completely and totally terrified. At that point, the familiar weatherman on KLST could be heard starting the Concho Valley 5-day forecast. It turned to static before he finished telling about Wednesday, partly cloudy with easterly winds at 15 to... Chris flinched at the grating sound of static, seemingly amplified louder than the actual volume of the television. Suddenly, the front door slammed to. This time he screamed, realizing that he was confined inside the house, disconnected from the community, with something very unusual happening. His body was flush with goosebumps, every hair standing on end as he stood frozen in fear. Suddenly, there was a loud banging emanating from the inside of the door to Laura's bedroom, as if something was trying to get out. He screamed again and ran to the front door, turning the doorknob and opening it about 1 foot when it slammed shut again, as if somebody were pushing it from behind. The panic was total. Chris was crying and screaming and trembling so violently that it seemed he might just collapse. He could sense that something was behind him, but didn't turn around to look. Instead, he tried the door again and was able to get it open this time. However, his hands were shaking so badly that he couldn't undo the latch that locked the screen closed. He was frantic, doing everything possible to lift the latch when there came a rush of cold air from behind, and a hand gripped his left shoulder. At that moment, the latch popped and Chris burst out of the screen door onto the front porch. To call the entrance to their blue-collar house a porch would be a stretch. It was really just a 10-by-10 concrete square that was elevated about 3 feet from the ground with concrete steps and a handrail. Chris ran out and jumped the stairs, landing on the sidewalk below with such forward momentum that he tripped and rolled onto the cracked concrete sidewalk, skinning his elbow where it was already scabbed from a previous fall in the M System parking lot. He stood up, holding the injured elbow with the opposing hand, and whirled around to look at the front door. Only the light of the living room was visible through the top half of the screen door. Chris stood there, trying to inhale, but on the verge of hyperventilating. He had no idea what to do next. Calling the police would require re-entering the house, and that was absolutely out of the question. Besides, he had a sense that this was not really a police matter. Running to Kyle's house seemed like a better option. This thought was culminating in his mind when the rectangle of light emanating from behind the screen darkened and the front door slammed shut. Chris took off running as fast as he possibly could. Kyle lived only 3 houses down on the other side of North Street. Chris ran to the front door and rang the doorbell several times in a panic. He started banging on the door when there was no immediate response, screaming in a high, raspy voice, "Help! Somebody! I need help!" The porch light turned on after what seemed like hours. There stood Robert, still dressed in his orange and black Central High School team colors. He and Jan were awake and had been watching TV in the living room. Jan came to the door just after Robert opened it to see Chris having a complete meltdown on her front porch. She pushed Robert aside and opened the glass door while asking, "What's wrong, Chris? Are you okay?" She noticed a stream of blood running down his right forearm. Jan zeroed in on the injury and asked with an alarmed voice, "Are you hurt? What happened to you?" Chris could hardly catch his breath or regain his composure. Jan knelt down and put a hand on his shoulder. "Calm down. You're okay. Tell me what happened." Chris finally pushed down the lump that was preventing him from speaking and blurted out, "Something is in my house." Robert asked if somebody had broken in. Chris tried to explain that he didn't think it was a person, but didn't know what it was. He told them that something was there and had called out to him, and it sounded just like Laura. He recounted how the doors slammed and told of the hand on his shoulder. Robert stared at him, perplexed and bewildered. "Do you think maybe you were dreaming? Did you watch something scary on TV?" Chris was frustrated by the question.
"No, this wasn't a dream. It was real. I was just watching the news and she called me. And the bedroom door was open and..."
Chris couldn't continue. He broke down completely. Jan hugged him and looked up at Robert with rage on her face.
"It's not right that she just leaves him there while she goes to work or whatever she does. No boy should be left alone at home night after night."
Then she took Chris's face in both of her hands and lifted his head until they made eye contact.
"From now on, you stay with us on nights that Laura has to work, okay? You're not staying by yourself at night anymore, understand?"
Chris nodded through his tears. Jan walked him into the house where Kyle was standing half asleep. The doorbell and the banging had awoken him. He became completely alert after seeing Chris walk in with Jan's hand on his shoulder.
"What's going on?"
Chris shook his head, and a silent understanding enveloped the two of them. Without knowing anything about what had just happened, Kyle asked, "Was it the shadows?" This was the first time that anybody had ever given the dark mass a proper name. Chris said that he didn't know, but that something really weird was going on at his house. Robert asked what they meant by the shadows. Kyle started to explain, but then hesitated and looked down, telling him,
"Never mind."
"Listen, Chris, I'm going to go check out your house. I'll leave a note for Laura so she knows where you are."
Chris nodded. Robert ran upstairs as Jan led Chris toward the bathroom to tend to his elbow. She was applying a bandage when they heard the front door open as Robert left to investigate. He returned only seconds later to retrieve pen and paper, and then he was off. Robert returned about 10 minutes later. Chris was surprised to see that he was holding a handgun. He was unaware that the Markhams owned a gun. Robert said that he couldn't find anybody in the house. He had left the note in a conspicuous place so that Laura would know where Chris had gone. Chris asked if the door to Laura's bedroom was open or closed. Robert responded that all of the doors were open, including the front door. He also added that almost all of the cabinets in the bathroom and the kitchen were open, which he thought was odd. He said that he had closed everything up and locked the front and back doors. Nothing seemed to be missing. Chris slept in a sleeping bag on Kyle's bedroom floor that night. He would have slept on Kyle's lower bunk, but James was there, even though he had his own bedroom. He had a difficult time shutting down the electricity that was whizzing from synapse to synapse as he processed everything that had happened. However, it was a drastic decline when sleep crept in. He was sore from being so tense throughout the ordeal, and more exhausted than he had ever been in his life, old Baldy notwithstanding. He was in a deep sleep by midnight. It was about 11 a.m. on Saturday morning when Chris returned home. He found the front door unlocked and Laura still asleep. She awoke shortly after noon. Chris was watching television and building with Legos when she emerged from the bedroom. He waited for her to ask why he ended up at Kyle's house on the previous night, but she didn't say anything. Jan's words were echoing in his mind as she stumbled toward the kitchen. No boy should be left alone at home night after night. This was the first time that he really came to understand that his relationship with Laura was not a good one. The interaction with his mother changed from that day forward. What started as general disappointment would eventually grow into a monster inside Christopher's heart. Later, he would project his disdain for Laura onto the entire town, wanting to get far away from West Texas as soon as possible. Halloween fell on the following Wednesday. None of the boys were real enthusiastic about it, except for Trent. He absolutely loved everything about the ghosts and ghouls. He biked to the Skaggs Albertsons grocery store often during the month of October. An enterprising manager at Skaggs also had an affinity for Halloween and made sure that they went all out for the holiday. The costume aisle was covered in black cloth, having torn strips adorning both ends. Inside the shrouded aisle were orange and red-colored lights with eerie music and sound effects playing on a cassette player that automatically oscillated between side A and side B. The aisle was stocked with costumes, makeup, props, and supplies. Trent would visit this wonderland as often as possible, sometimes just sitting on the floor and absorbing the environment. This year he discovered fake skin in the makeup area and decided to create his own costume instead of purchasing an existing one. He did love the odd smell of the glazed cardboard that was used for the pre-made masks, even to the point that he would pretend to try them on just to breathe it in. That smell would take him back to the memories of Halloween as a child for the rest of his life. Everybody had agreed to go trick-or-treating together on Halloween night. Kyle explained that James was going to join them, and they were all fine with that. They met at Kyle's house in the early evening. Everybody was dressed up as something, but nobody put the effort into their costume that Trent did. Kyle was a pirate and James was a mummy, a choice he came to regret as he later became overheated. Their costumes had been purchased from Furr's Grocery in the Southwest Plaza. James supplemented his with some gauze and two ankle wraps on his arms. Justin was wearing a suit with a mask of President Carter. Edna, who always planned ahead, came across the mask at a Fiesta del Concho booth during the previous summer. She kept it specifically for Halloween. Chris was an Ewok that he found at Kmart. Emmett was a robot. Most of his costume was bought from Skaggs, but he did embellish it with some dryer hoses on his arms, which caused him to lumber around like the robot from Lost in Space, unable to lay his arms down flat. Then there was Trent. He showed up with fake skin protruding from his cheeks, chin, nose, and forehead. Needles were poking through the synthetic blemishes in all directions. None of the needles were perpendicular to his face, because his mother forbade it, just in case he fell or was hit by something. Dripping from each pinprick was vampire blood that had been applied liberally and ran down onto his shredded white T-shirt. He also wore jean shorts that were shredded and had been doused in red dye. His intention was that the shorts would look bloody, but the dye turned so dark on the denim that it was almost black. That was supplemented with red tempera paint that he used to draw streaks of blood from his knees to his ankles. He used the same paint to completely cover his feet and wore flip-flops to ensure that they would be visible. However, he left the house while the paint was still wet and had collected a substantial amount of dust and grime during the journey to Kyle's house. Consequently, the bloody feet looked more like the mud from the Red Arroyo Creek that traversed College Hills Boulevard. The red tinge of the paint stayed on his skin for weeks after. Around his neck, he wore several chain necklaces. His blonde hair was sprayed with black and red-colored hairspray. The whole costume was assembled using supplies purchased from Skaggs, along with some needles from his mother's sewing kit, dye from beneath the kitchen sink, paint from their garage, and some worn-out clothing. Trent was the last to arrive at Kyle's house. He wanted to be fashionably late for his grand unveiling. The whole group stood in the front yard awaiting his arrival. They gawked when he showed up on his bike. Emmett initially thought that he had pushed the needles through his own skin due to the realism of the costume. There was laughter and high fives as all admitted that Trent had outdone himself, and all of them. The only problem was that nobody could determine what he was supposed to be. It was just a random collection of gore that didn't seem to correspond to any known character. He told them that he was Frankenstein's son. Justin challenged this by making the point that Frankenstein was the name of the mad scientist and not the monster that he created. Trent rebutted that everybody calls the monster Frankenstein too. Justin wasn't sure if that was true, but he didn't have a good comeback, so the matter was dropped. The first order of business was to ride to Austin Elementary for the Halloween carnival. Door-to-door trick-or-treating would follow. Jan was reluctant to let James go with them, but Robert felt confident of the safety in numbers. Trent was only a little older and even in the same grade. So what's the problem? His motive was mixed. If James didn't go with the group, then Robert would have to escort him, while Jan stayed back to take care of Brenda and answer the door. James never considered this and thought that Robert was just a cool dad that wanted him to have a good time. Dusk was upon them, and the air was brisk and clean, smelling of autumn as they rode down North Harrison Street toward Austin Elementary. Emmett shed the dryer hoses almost immediately upon arrival due to the limited mobility. They were tossed in the dumpster behind the cafeteria. The carnival was in full swing, and the bike rack was almost full by the time they arrived. Everybody had brought some money, but the accounts were nowhere close to even. Chris had only $3, while Kyle and James had 20 between the two of them. Justin, Emmett, and Trent each had about $4 and some change. They decided to pool the cash and buy as many tickets as possible at 50 cents each, then split them evenly and stick together. They walked away from the ticket booth with about 70 tickets and felt like millionaires. The group traveled from booth to booth and won loads of prizes and candy. There was some infighting when they disagreed on which game to visit next, but they were always able to come to a consensus. Trent refused to bob for apples because of his extravagant costume that was attracting copious attention from both kids and adults. Classmates joined into the group along the way, but they always departed soon after because nobody had the same rapport as those in the pack. The ticket soon whittled down to only 24. Emmett suggested that they spend those on the haunted house that was set up in one of the sixth-grade classrooms. The price of admission was 4 tickets per person, which would consume the remainder of their stash. The so-called haunted house was actually a maze made up of refrigerator boxes laid end-to-end and taped together. The inside was black with fluorescent paint depicting skulls, apparitions, and other ghostly entities. Black lights were shining down through the circular holes. One was hanging too close to the maze ceiling when the night began and had caused the cardboard to start smoking until Coach Simmons raised it. That caused the room to have a strange burned cardboard smell. The 2 doors to the sixth grade classroom were used as the entrance and exit. Both were shrouded in black crepe paper that covered the entrance and exit doors. The participant would pay the ticket taker and then hunch down or get on all fours and enter the maze, eventually exiting out the other door on the north side of the room. Along the way were various jump scares, such as a bang on the outside of the cardboard or a glowing eyeball suspended on a flap that would fall down in front of the unsuspecting victim. The boys entered with Kyle in the lead, followed by James, then Chris, Trent, Emmett, and Justin taking up the rear. They stayed together as a group down the initial run that went straight all the way from the entrance to the back of the room. After rounding the corner, Kyle was confronted with a fork, one side going straight and the other angled off to the left. He assumed that the left option would probably lessen the duration of the experience, since it seemed to point in the general direction of the exit. Therefore, he went straight. All boys followed Kyle except for Justin. He was the last in line behind Emmett, and when he encountered the same fork in the maze, he decided to go down the angled run in hopes that it would connect back up. His plan was to listen for them rustling around through the cardboard so as to anticipate the moment that Kyle would emerge. Then he could jump out of the darkness and scare Kyle much more than any of the cheesy antics that were being employed by the faculty and staff that were operating the attraction. Justin quietly slipped into the left arm of the fork and accelerated his crawling with the intention to beat Kyle to the merge and ambush him. He started to question the decision after going only about 5 feet and discovering that there were no black lights or glowing caricatures on the walls or ceiling. It was just a pitch-black tunnel. He was more than a little unsettled by the extreme darkness, and the experience was further heightened by being alone and the silence that engulfed him. No longer could he hear teachers banging on cardboard at the entrance as new participants entered the maze. The sound effects, music, and voices were gone. Justin felt along the walls for about 10 feet, then decided to turn back and try to catch up with Emmett. However, when he turned to go back the other way, he saw no nearby black light or glowing decorations. In fact, he saw nothing. It was just as black and foreboding behind as ahead. He assumed that it must have wound around in such a way that any light from behind was blocked, so he started crawling back at a faster pace. Fear started to really set in after retracing at least as many steps as had led him to the turnaround point. He was certain that he should have reached the entrance to the fork, but was still in complete darkness and could hear nothing. He continued crawling faster and faster, eventually calling out for help, but getting no response. Fear heightened with each passing second until he transitioned into a full panic and started kicking and punching the walls of the maze. Try as he might, he could not break through the thick cardboard. It seemed almost as if the boxes had been triple-layered. No matter how hard he kicked or punched, the walls and ceiling would give, but remained intact. Justin started moving again, frantic for any sign of light. After a few more feet, his hand encountered something odd. He stopped and fell back, horrified at what he may have just touched. Slowly he reached out his hand and touched it again. It was unmistakably the top of somebody's head. He fell back into a sitting position and heard the crack of a prize that he had won at one of the carnival booths. It was a new product at Skaggs Albertsons that all the kids wanted, a glow stick. The group had left their spoils on the table in the hallway when they entered the maze, but Justin forgot that he had placed the glow stick in his back pocket. A faint light started to emanate from the plastic vial as he pulled it from his back pocket. Then, with great trepidation, he leaned forward and raised the light over the obstacle. He was at first relieved to see that it was Trent, laying face up with blood everywhere. Justin thought that the pool of blood was part of Trent's outlandish costume, but he was horrified when he leaned further to see that Justin's eyes were open, one more than the other, and they were both glazed over. The coagulated blood had flown out of a large gash on Trent's forehead, emitting a nauseating smell. Justin knew instinctively what it was, although had never smelled that before. Trent Brennan was lying in front of him on the cardboard floor, reeking of death. Justin let out a broken, high-pitched scream and turned to flee in the opposite direction. He was even more horrified to see his mother, Claire, sitting in front of him, slumped over with hands in front, palms facing up. Again, blood was everywhere, emanating from somewhere on her head, and also both of her wrists. Her face was mutilated and looked more like raw hamburger than his mother. A steady stream was flowing off her lower lip, or what was left of it. Justin completely lost control and started thrashing in a blind fear. He kicked and punched and screamed, trying to break through the cardboard in such a panic that initially he didn't see the ray of light that shone through as the boxes separated at a seam. The face of Coach Simmons looked down as he pulled the boxes apart to reveal a screaming, horrified child, flailing at nothing. He knelt down and grabbed Justin by the shoulders, shaking him while exclaiming, "It's okay! You're okay! Hey, calm down, son!" Justin froze and stopped screaming. He looked at the coach, wide-eyed and trembling, unable to speak. He pointed left without looking, expecting that Coach Simmons would see Trent in a pool of blood. The coach looked, but saw only the inside of the maze, painted with fluorescent goblins and illuminated by the black light. His eyes met with Justin's, and the two seemed to communicate without speaking. Then Justin looked to where he had just pointed to see exactly what the coach saw. There was no body, and the passage was perfectly illuminated. His head swung right to see the same, nothing but black light and the hastily painted mural. White light from the classroom was also streaming in around the edges of the black lights. The teachers had turned them on when they heard Justin's screams and saw the boxes moving as he attempted to create his own exit. Justin was beside himself, exclaiming, "There are bodies! Trent and my mom! They were dead!" The coach didn't speak. It was obvious to Justin that he either didn't understand or didn't believe him. He placed his hands beneath Justin's armpits and lifted him up, forcing him to stand, wobbly and shaking. Justin scanned the room to see several adults staring in stunned silence. He heard one of them say, "I told you this was too much. I knew some kid was going to freak out." Justin tried to speak, but he still could not regain his composure. It bothered him that a teacher would think their cheesy, haunted maze could be the source of his fear, but he didn't counter. Two faces were peering through the crepe paper at the exit. It was Kyle and Chris. Both had very concerned expressions, as if they knew something that none of the adults in the room were aware of. Kyle noticed that Justin was trying to communicate with the coach, but could not assemble a coherent sentence, and so he yelled out, "He's our friend!" The coach looked at the two boys and then at Justin, waffling between simply offloading this very perplexing little problem or calling for some professional help. He had no idea as to whom he should call for a boy having a psychotic break on Halloween night, and so he opted for the easy way out and led Justin to the exit. There was just enough clearance between the edge of the exit box and the door jamb for Justin to squeeze through. Then he was back out in the hallway, surrounded by his friends and almost catatonic from the trauma that he had just endured. The dichotomy could not have been more stark. Clutched in his left hand was the green glow stick, which only emphasized how badly he was shaking. Chris placed his hand behind Justin's elbow and said, "Come on." He pulled with the expectation that Justin would follow, but he didn't move. Chris made eye contact with Justin and said, "Justin, come with us." Justin nodded slowly and muttered, "Yeah, okay." The six boys walked outside to the causeway between the main campus and the cafeteria. They sat down on a row of concrete benches, and Kyle asked him to explain exactly what had just happened. Justin was still in shock and could hardly speak. Kyle continued working to pry information out of Justin until he finally said, "You won't believe me." James was the next to speak. It was out of character for him to engage, as he always felt intimidated by the strong personalities in the group, but he had purpose in his voice when he asked, "Was it the shadows?" Justin looked at him and answered a question with a question. "How do you know about that?" Kyle realized that Justin didn't know about what happened on Old Baldy. He had only seen the shadows at Little Africa, and James wasn't with them. "Never mind, we'll tell you later. Now explain exactly what you saw in there." Justin went on to describe the whole chronology from the moment he entered the left fork of the maze until Coach Simmons pulled the boxes apart. Trent piped up with a joke when he told about the first body, saying, "Why am I always the dead guy? You got a problem with me, punk?" His effort to bring levity to the situation was fruitless. Emmett didn't move his eyes from Justin when he said, "Shut up, Trent." Chris was the first to speak after Justin finished explaining what had happened. "I think it was the shadows. I think you were inside a shadow and it caused you to see things and feel things and smell things, things that weren't real." Justin explained how real it all seemed, but Kyle interjected that it had all happened in the span of only about 1 minute or two at the most, because that was roughly how long it took for them to exit the maze, and they all heard Justin screaming well before they reached the end. Emmett asked, "How long did it seem to you?" Justin responded that he had been wandering around in that black abyss for at least 10 to 15 minutes. This affirmed Chris's conclusion that it was something like a vision, something that didn't really happen but seemed completely real. Something that compressed or expanded time. For a moment, he wondered if the incident at his house on Friday had also been an illusion. But then he remembered that Robert said all the doors were open. Of course, that could have been an actual person that broke in after he left. Maybe. Just maybe. Justin didn't feel confident returning home and sleeping alone in his bedroom. Therefore, the whole group escorted him home, and Kyle asked if Justin could sleep over. Edna called it highly irregular, but she agreed after some coaxing. Justin committed to be home by 7:30 a.m. the following morning so that Edna could drive him to the Catholic school downtown. He gathered some clothing and a toothbrush before departing with Kyle and James. The others all went to their respective homes. Chris, Emmett, and Trent were leery as they rode their bicycles home alone in the dark, but there were still some kids going house to house, so they didn't feel entirely alone. As for the six boys, there would be no more trick-or-treating on this night. Everybody except for James was still awake at midnight as October of 1979 came to an end. They were all thinking about what had happened to Justin. Justin himself was in the top bunk with Kyle. He couldn't bear to be on the floor alone, even in the same room. He thought Kyle was asleep, and Kyle thought he was. But they were both still contemplating what it all meant. They finally fell asleep one by one sometime in the early morning of November 1st. First Emmett, then Trent, Chris, Kyle, and finally Justin. Sister Martinez noticed that Justin was particularly distracted during class on Thursday. She almost missed their banter as she was used to a disrespectful or demeaning comment whenever work was assigned or he was called upon. She caught him in the carpool line at the end of the day just as he was about to get into Edna's Plymouth, asking, "Is everything all right, Justin?" He responded in an uncharacteristically muted tone and almost immediately tried to compensate with a false enthusiasm through a broken smile.
"Of course. Why do you ask?"
She saw through the facade and reminded him that they had a school counselor if he ever needed to talk. He gave it another go with,
"You kidding? She'd need counseling after she talked to me."
Sister Martinez did not feign a smile. She reached into her habit and pulled out a small wooden cross and a rosary while saying,
"I'd like for you to have this, Justin."
He attempted to compose a catty response, but only got as far as,
"I already have."
His words trailed off as he choked up. He was overtaken by a very unexpected and unwelcome rush of emotion. Justin had been so disturbed by the experience on Halloween night that he was basically numb. For some reason, that fully bewildered his bellicose disposition. This act of kindness from Sister Martinez tripped emotions that were wholly beyond his ability to comprehend or control. He had no way of knowing that Claire's abandonment had caused unspeakable trauma to settle and fester deep within his cellular memory. Then, to have been accosted by something so evil, so unholy and horrifying, he was truly an emotional wreck, although the outward appearance seemed to convey a boy in control of both himself and his environment. Until now. He had not accumulated enough life experience for retrospective analysis, nor did he have any education to help understand the chain reaction that was underway in his members due to Claire's abandonment and the assault on his sanity at Austin Elementary. He was completely unprepared for the emotional outburst that was thrust upon him by his own physiology. It was even larger than that. He had been broken at a deeply spiritual level, but had no capability to understand or cope with it. A well of emotion sprung up from that bottomless pit and erupted with such explosive force that Justin was unable to contain it. Sister Martinez seemed to have a sixth sense about Justin's fragile state. She had concluded by late morning that something was amiss. The Justin that she knew just one day prior was nowhere to be found. On this day, for some reason that she could only sense but not know, that punk who gave her so much grief was broken and hurting with such a visceral aura that she could feel the sense of hopelessness that had overtaken the 11-year-old boy. An unspoken understanding enveloped them as the tears welled in his eyes and gravity pulled them down. The flood came when the dam burst, and he just stood and stared, completely motionless, as the waters streamed from his lower jaw onto the unforgiving concrete. Sister Martinez cupped his right hand and placed the cross and the rosary inside it. Then she folded his fingers around the symbols of faith. She knelt down and locked eyes with Justin, piercing his spirit to the very marrow, and told him,
"You are not alone. You will never be alone. If you ever feel alone or afraid, hold on to this and remember. hold on to this and remember that you are not alone."
Justin nodded slowly and attempted to regain his composure. For some reason, none of the other children noticed this exchange between the usually militant nun and the recalcitrant jerk that she had to cope with day after day. It was as if they were shielded for a moment from all of the ridicule and pain that inevitably comes with humanity's disjointed and fragmented existence. She stood and placed a hand on his shoulder, guiding him to the back seat of Edna's car. Edna rolled down the passenger side window with an incredulous demeanor. She was about to ask what he had done today when Sister Martinez leaned into the window and said,
"Everything is fine. Justin did really great today."
These words were the polar opposite of what Edna had expected, but she was relieved. She thanked Sister Martinez and pulled out of the carpool line, feeling pressured for having taken too long with several cars waiting impatiently behind her. Edna drove toward home, moving at a good clip on West Beauregard and going just a little bit faster than the speed limit, as was her custom. The passenger side window was still down, and that bothered her more and more with each passing second. She was approaching the Wholesome Bakery when the noise and the wind became unbearable. She pulled into the parking lot, intending to roll up the window. However, both Edna and Justin were suddenly smitten with the aroma of hot donuts, fresh from the oven. She did roll up the window, but then looked in the rearview mirror at Justin, who was staring out the window and still had the sup-sups from the conversation with Sister Martinez.
"I think we need some donuts, don't you?"
Justin turned to look at her, his body flooded with endorphins and kephalins and dopamine from the torrent of emotion. The wafting sweet smell of the fresh donuts, combined with Edna's general disposition, and the very unexpected and timely kindness shown by Sister Martinez, further pulled him up from the emotional chasm. His countenance was transitioning from despondency to peace, and Edna's proposal furthered the emergence. He cracked a half-smile and responded,
"Yes, I do. I think we both need some hot, steamy, gooey donuts right now."
They both exited the car and entered the wonderland that was the Wholesome Bakery. Justin noticed the Strike It Rich department store as they exited with a white box containing a dozen blazing hot glazed donuts. It was formerly called BW Merchandise, but one day the sign inexplicably changed to Strike It Rich. This was another of Christopher Bennett's many complaints, quite similar to the mission of identifying the real Little Africa over the imposter next to G&N. Justin thought of Chris when he saw the sign that was splotched with colorful ink blots to make it stand out from the noise on West Beauregard. He giggled as he opened the car door, pondering the irrelevancy of the store name against the raw passion of Chris, exclaiming,
"What a stupid name! Why did they ever change it? BW's was better."
This was almost always followed by an emphatic and determined,
"They need to change it back."
The cause was made even more humorous by the fact that it wasn't even called BW's. That was just Chris's shorthand that he'd used for so long that he came to think it was the actual name. Justin thought on all of this as a black cloud dispersed from inside his heart with each chuckle. His spirit was light and his attitude completely different at school the next day. Sister Martinez noticed it, but she didn't say anything. Justin knew that the upcoming weekend might be a major event because they were slated to return to Little Africa. He spent much of the day contemplating that and wondering what awaited them. He was only 2 days removed from the horror of the shadows, and to some extent the healing had already begun, thanks to the discernment and compassion of Sister Martinez.